Good morning.
Afternoon.
Okay. Well, the sun's shining. That's the important part.
It is indeed.
So welcome to the End of Seeking podcast, episode...
I think it's 16, is it?
16 this week, okay. Great. So what an exciting weekend you had, right?
Yes, I did.
You went to the... We talked about it last week, I think. We were heading off to the... Heart of the Rose Festival in Kent, in Tunbridge Wells, or near enough. And you did a talk there?
I did on Sunday morning, yes.
Great. So you went down there before the weekend, spent some a couple of days, did your talk. And how was it?
The talk or the festival?
Well, what happened? what jumps to mind?
The talk was beautiful. Yeah. It was very, very sweet energy. Mm-hmm. The people that came to the talk were very present and very welcoming. And there was a softness of energy there that was really... felt all-encompassing, I think, is the feeling, the word that's there for me today.
It was an all-female festival, right?
It was, and I think that's the first time I've really been in such a space like that. And I'm still digesting. It's sort of hard to speak about it. I mean, I only arrived back yesterday. And so I'm still very much integrating and processing what this weekend was for me. The feeling of it is there, but the words aren't necessarily quite caught up yet. But the word profound is there. Very heart opening. It's entirely different to be in a space of all females. And it felt ancient. It felt like there was a gathering, you know, it seems cliche to say, but a gathering of the sisters. And it was people of all ages, of all backgrounds. There were people from all over the world actually there.
It was a spiritual festival though, right? I mean, it represented in different types of spirituality, but it was not just a...
Yeah, all centered around the teachings of the rose, the heart of the rose. And
what would you say that was, as you understand it?
As I understand it, it is the teachings of embodied love. It is the feminine aspect of awakening. And it's something that I'm very called to and I'm very drawn to and feel that I've been teaching from, maybe not overtly all the time.
It's definitely been showing up more and more in your offering, your expression.
Yeah. You know, and so in my talk, I spoke a little bit about my story. And I've certainly never... shied away from being completely open and honest, but there are certain aspects of my story that have yet to be fully told, I feel. And I felt I began, you know, certainly one-on-one, I've shared a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, but I did that conscious TV interview sort of 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
And a lot has happened since then in my personal story. Lot has happened. And those that have worked with me, certainly the fruition of that in terms of what I speak of is obvious, but my personal story hasn't really...
updated.
No.
And the story continues, doesn't it?
Oh, God, yeah, it does.
We continue to unfold and blossom in our insight and...
Yeah. And I think it's a hard thing to stay updated and stay fresh with that. in terms of an outward offering, if you know what I mean.
I think it sort of has to, I mean, in terms of telling one's story, and I know in sort of non-dual circles, that's very much, yeah, but it's yeah. it's how we make sense of the happening yeah. of life. But, you know, going through it, you have to first have the experience of, mm-hmm. of what it is to live whatever you're living over time.
Yep.
And then in some sense, you've got to have a little enough space so you can look exactly. back upon it and then let a narrative emerge.
Exactly.
That becomes a shorthand. Because I'm not against telling stories about who and what we are. And certainly there are self-limiting and disempowering stories that we can tell and do tell sometimes. But in general, we communicate through narrative and yeah. Just don't take it to be ultimately true, but
yeah,
but
hold it very lightly.
My point is that you need to actually get out, like the exactly. last 3 years, get a little distance from it before yeah. you can go back and then re-narratize.
Yeah, and so I've been feeling this calling certainly for the last 6 months or so, the necessity to start to begin to share my story a little more.
So this weekend, you got an opportunity to express some more of that?
I did, a certain aspect of that. And I mean, it's hard because a story is only ever one snippet, one thread of a narrative, and doesn't represent the wholeness. You can't possibly capture that. And so it was very... I didn't go too much into it because a lot of the talk I was giving was actually a satsang, so there was a lot of questions and answers.
Right.
But yeah, I just went a little bit more into my story, and in particular, and it was so perfect because the stage that I was speaking on was the Mother Mary stage.
Right.
The heart wisdom stage. And it was perfect because for those that maybe don't know, well, mainly because I haven't overtly made it known, my story has been my personal journey with Divine Mother in the form of Mother Mary. And so it felt very sort of poetic, maybe, to be sharing this on the Mother Mary stage.
Great supportive and context.
Yeah. Perfect. Entirely perfect. I'm always in two minds as to how much to share. You know, I think it's even on my website, this comment of, you know, it's hard to, I don't see much of a purpose of sharing the story because, you know, I'd much rather be in the living exploration and meeting of the people we see in front of us rather than telling a story. You know, I feel like sometimes if there's too much of that, it sort of can take away. It can, people assume that they have to match a story. They have to follow a path in terms of a story, and that's what their experience has to be. And so there's this sort of fine line, I feel, of getting too caught in the story.
Yeah.
And yet finding our common ground within those stories and finding the sort of the deeper meaning, the deeper narrative, the archetypal, what's the word, journey that can be found in these stories. So yeah, my story, my personal journey in the last 3 years at least. No, God, it's been longer now. Now I think of it intensely in the last 3 years. But it started when I started to give transmissions. So that's what, almost 7 years ago now.
Right. Yeah, I remember that took on this modality, which was effective and which was powerful. And but pretty soon I could see, or you reported that, I'm feeling it differently. But it took you a minute to sort of trust your your own way, or what energies, what intelligence is you were
being the conduit for, the channeling.
Yeah.
It's like, so yeah, we both at the same time learned to give Raza in 2017. And that had a very particular energy to it. It's a very powerful energy. It's much more akin, associated with Kali Ma.
Yeah.
And it has a clarity to it, an uncompromising clarity to it, a white light energy to it.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful, but I had a really hard time connecting with that energy from the get-go, actually. Mm. And I think it was about 6 months into that. Like I've always had a hard time connecting in with Kali Ma somehow. But yeah, 6 months into giving these Razas, there was a different kind of energy that started to come through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was altogether softer, altogether sweeter. And it was very much a pull into the heart. You know, the Razas are very much focused on the crown. And coming down a little bit, but very, very much about the crown there, about opening the crown. And they were very, it was very effective for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was, myself, was, it was like this energy was seeping in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at the time really rejecting that. Oh, no, I'm doing it wrong. This is wrong. This shouldn't be this way.
Yeah,
I'm
it's not
doing
how
a Raza.
You were taught. So.
Yeah. And it's funny now I look at it, and you know, Kali Ma is the Divine Mother too in a different form. But I think, I don't know, it's something I'm coming to see now even more and more. It's like there's something about the Raza energy that felt a little masculine. I guess because it was in the realm of the transcendence still.
Well, I like, it's funny you were saying when you came back from this weekend and you told me, well, you told a little bit about your story, and one of the things that struck me was you said that you were raised, which is true, you know, with meditation and, you know, TM and all those kind of teaching, with transcendental teachings.
Yeah.
Satsang
and non-duality,
all of that
is transcendental.
And it seems to me
it's sinking into the silence.
Yes, and it's beautiful and profound, but there is a sense that...
And necessary.
Your work seems to me to be much more... Oh, obviously, that's essential.
Yes,
in fact, that's the missing piece for
entirely.
Most people. That's the cause of suffering, is the alienation from our boundless awareness nature.
Exactly. It's entirely
so
necessary.
So you have to get that, the ground.
Yeah.
Find the ground of awareness that you are.
Yeah.
And live from there.
Yes.
But there, as you say, it's just, it can be alienating if you, as Ajahn used to say, you get lost in the transcendent.
Yeah.
It can be alienating then to the manifestations.
Exactly.
There's a subtle rejection, even though we know from that place of pure awareness that all this is a passing phenomena.
Yeah.
But at the same time, all this is that. All this is that boundless awareness
all
too.
All this passing phenomena.
And so we talked about this before, this subtle, maybe even unconscious rejection of the manifestation.
Yeah. And I'm called more and more to, and it's a lot of, if you listen to a lot of what I'm speaking on, I would say the overarching theme of what I'm currently talking about is that of inclusion.
Yeah.
And it didn't used to be like that at all. I see.
Be clear, your inclusion, you're talking about the inclusion of all experience.
Right. Yes. Good. And it didn't used to be that. That wasn't my focus. It was never not my focus, as in it wasn't like
it's
I didn't speak about
become more explicitly
that.
So.
Yeah.
Consciously so.
And to me, what that requires is surrender and is an open heart. That's the fragrance of inclusion, is unconditional love.
Yeah.
To surrender to it all.
To welcome it all.
Yeah. The pain, the suffering, the delight, the love. And it's been a profound journey for me. And a journey that's sort of taken everything. It's taken every part of me into it. And it continues to do so, I think.
I think there's an ever deepening, isn't there? I feel this. There's the ever deepening, but also the ever blossoming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just continues to unpack and fold. Blossom is a nice word because that's how it feels. Or like, you know, as you go deeper into it, like the wellspring of being springs up to meet that also. Yeah. It's like it's in all directions.
It is. It really is. And it's like a constant breaking open to life. That's how I would describe my path. You know, we talked about paths last week. It's a pathless path. But it is. It's like my journey, my experience of life is a constant breaking open to all that is life. And that's a challenging journey. I mean, it leaves nothing left behind.
And just to make the point here, this is the journey, let's say, quotes, that you're on and is happening. And it's not like a choice, really, is it?
It's not at all. And it's sort of an odd journey to be having semi-publicly as well,
right?
I would say. And that's the thing I've been not struggling with, because it's not a struggle, but it's something I've been aware of these last couple of years, certainly the last 6 months very strongly, that what I share, as some would call it my teaching, although I don't relate to it in that way, but what I share, how I meet people, is evolving, is changing constantly. And it's very hard to, therefore, you know, when someone says, what do you do? I got asked that on this weekend so many times, you know, when it was made known, you know, oh, I'm going to be speaking on Sunday. Well, what are you talking about? What do you do?
Right.
And honestly, it is so, so, so hard.
Right.
And that's what I'm feeling of, like, my website, for instance, feels outdated. It doesn't feel current. It doesn't feel like it's the current expression of who and what I am and what I speak on. It's not wrong. It is part of me, but I've also evolved beyond that.
So you have to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, somewhat. Or at least evolve.
Well,
it.
I remember you did it a couple of years ago because you were in, again, you were same like, thing. Oh, my understanding, my expression, my sense of who I am, what I'm doing, how I'm doing it, where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
You were like, it's not reflected. I have to go in and, you know, rebuild.
Yeah. And
and that's beautiful,
it
actually.
It is.
Too.
And it's hard, you know, to, I think I see some people go out there and start offering stuff and they get stagnated in their offering because there is a certain, I don't even know how to describe this in words, you might have a better chance at it, but it's like there's a certain impulse to plant your sort of flag in the sand and this is me, this is what I have to say. And it's hard to, the lived reality of awakening is not just a full stop. It's a constant evolution.
I think it's interesting. The image of a lobster comes up.
Oh, yeah.
Well, our being is flux. It's soft. It's tender. It's boundless. It's, you know, it's all that. But in order to express, we have to say something, write something down. If you want to, you know, even communicate to someone that who you are and what you're doing and what you're offering, you have to write something down.
Yeah.
It's like the lobster shell, because what happens is the lobster kind of grows a shell. I might be wrong, might be a crab, but I think it's a lobster. Grows a shell. And sort of manifest this expression of protection and you know, around itself, its exoskeleton, and then but it's continuing to grow inside it, and every once in a while it has to shed the shell completely.
Oh, like a hermit crab.
I thought lobsters did it. Yeah, they do. They shed, I'm pretty sure. So they shed the shell. And so for a while in there, they're quite vulnerable and open and unformed, you know, until another sort of shell, another thing comes around it. And that happens intermittently, because inside they continue to grow and change. But outside, once it gets hard, it's like once you write something down, it's set somehow. Yeah. And the only thing you can do is get rid of it. And start grow a new one.
And I found this hard from the start. The constant feeling of that shell for me feels wrong. To be defined, to be sort of caged, so to speak, in structure.
Yeah, but it's a sort of an inevitable part of this process life. Of being and living. Yeah, you have to communicate where you are. Meanwhile, inside, there's all these changes going on. I guess you just got to keep updating. And you're right about it. Don't be too keen to plant a flag and that's it. I'm done here and no further. I see how you've been doing it with your, you know, how you're speaking about what you do and what you offer and whatnot and who you are, where you're coming from.
I have to be okay with living in the mystery of it all, living in the unknowingness of it all, living in the brokenheartedness of it all, actually. And a broken heart, you know, you say that word and most people think that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's the broken open heart.
Yeah,
it's not brokenhearted in terms of the human idea of broken heart, like that grief.
Yeah.
But it what I mean is more of a, let's call it...
an unshelled heart or something like that.
There you go.
Cracked open, raw, tender, vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, it's a really raw place to live from. It's a very powerful place to live from. And so to sort of continue a little with my story, just say, so yeah, Divine Mother in the form of Mary started coming to me, although at the time I didn't know it was her. It was just the energy. I could feel it, that softness, that sweetness, that all-encompassing compassion. That was the energy of the transmission that was coming, that I initially rejected. For quite a while I rejected it, actually, for months. And I remember there was a pivotal time we sort of stopped giving Raza at a certain point, and I stopped giving transmissions. And I remember she came, and the words that she said were, "Your voice is my voice. And my voice is your voice." No, I'm getting it wrong. It was, "Your words are my words, and my words are your words." Mm. She later on said voice, but yeah. And that was the okay for me to trust what was coming through. And so I started giving the transmissions again.
Did you? As I recall, did you say something like, I'm with you," or something like that? Something.
Yeah.
There was this very strong message. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which really got your back, actually. You know, really kind of filled you, and there was this with, but also, unified. It was. I remember. I remember you shifted.
I did shift.
Like in terms of your just own sense of what you were doing, who you were, what was the doubts seemed to fritter away.
Well, up until that point, I'd always looked.
Sorry, just had to answer the door. Okay, so do you remember what you were saying?
No, I don't actually. I said I was going to remember, and then I didn't.
You're hopelessly like a goldfish.
I am, but yeah, I know the sentiment. No,
up until that point is what you
said. Up until that point, I had always given over to an outer authority.
Yeah, how to do it, what,
and in whatever. Particular, they all happened to be male outer authorities that were very much focused on the transcendent.
Right.
Just that's how it happened to go. And it's like that whole thing happened where we stopped giving Raza and Divine Mother started to come to me.
Mm.
And it was like that was my calling to stand in my truth further, to own my own insights and the light that I am.
Yeah.
We all are.
Yeah.
And so that was a very pivotal moment for me, and that was sort of back in 2018.
I remember it well.
But it's taken years to really come into that, and in those intervening years, Divine Mother has come more and more, has become more solid, for want of a better word. Her words, her energy, her voice, her being, her physical form has appeared more and more in my life. And it wasn't until, I don't know, last 6 months or so. Actually, last year and a half, but it was about 6 months ago where I finally was like, oh, I get it.
Right.
And I remember her saying at the time, yes.
Right.
And this kind of yes that I could never forget, because it was the kind of yes that was like, yes, you get it. And I have infinite patience for the fact that you haven't been getting it.
Oh, she said, yeah, that was
her. Yeah, that was the yes. Okay. It was all said in this one right, yes.
Yeah, beautiful.
But the meaning of it was absolutely undeniable, of like the patient mother going, when I finally went, oh yeah, God, I get it. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
The patient mother going, yes, finally.
But not impatiently. No, or like not finally,
at all. Not at all. Such a sweetness, such a aha moment.
Mm.
And it was the recognition of, ah, you are my teacher.
Mm.
And it is your teaching that I am teaching.
Mm.
It is who you are. Embody who you are a symbol of. That is what I'm teaching.
Hmm. Well, I see it. I mean, I see how you are as a person, as a being, loving, welcoming, patient, compassionate, tender, wise.
Me cry.
You are the embodiment of that. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? As she as you are.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, how it might be, there is perhaps a difference between the masculine and the feminine approach, and maybe that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is the feminine, the divine feminine approach, which is inclusive and holistic and including and patient and holding and welcoming.
Whereas, and very much about the body as well.
Right.
Like the physicality. It's the recognition that I am beyond my body. I am prior to my body, but it is through my body that I feel.
Mm.
And I think the feminine, and this is, doesn't mean men or women, it's the feminine, and I believe that there is the masculine and feminine in all.
Yeah.
And actually there needs to be a union and a balance of that in all, in different measures, obviously. But it's the path of the heart and the senses, the felt experience. You know, I see the masculine way as very, there's a lot of clarity. There's a lot of clarity in the mind there that comes about. In those paths, in those ways of being, the intellect is beautifully used as a wonderful tool there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sharp. It has a lot of structure to it. It has a lot of, in many ways, knowingness there. And what I see in the sort of the more feminine embodiment of love is a falling into the mystery, falling into the felt sense. And like I said, it's both. It's for all. But there can be a deeper emphasis on one or the other, depending on the expression.
If there's a lack of one of those aspects, then it's going to show up as a sort of a pathology or an unhealthy bias in one's experience.
Yeah.
But you know, the healthier teachings are, and I've always felt, are contain both.
They do.
You know, the nyan, the insight, of pure knowledge and pure experience on that level. But this dropping into the heart, the bhakti needs to be included.
Yeah.
The devotion of the heart, that actually unifies all these apparent divisions, paradoxes.
Yeah.
The heart holds it, the mind can't. No. But you have to awaken the mind and open the heart. That's the fullness of the awakened expression of the awakened being. It's an awake mind and an open heart.
Yeah. This I just want to read this that came the night before my talk. I was awake at 3 a.m. rather
anticipating the morning after.
Yes, and there was quite a lot that came, actually. I got quite a lot of, there was a lot going on that night, obviously. I mean, this was a fairly big deal for me to be sharing in person for the first time like this. I've never done that before. I felt it coming, but it's just life hasn't provided that opportunity until today, this weekend. So there was a lot going on for me. But this one little bit came up, and I think it speaks to maybe my view of life. When we meet difficult experiences, thoughts, feelings, emotions, we are offered an opportunity to surrender even more deeply into our true nature, which both transcends and yet includes all that is arising. With tender curiosity, an alchemy of transformation occurs. So yeah, the transcendence and the inclusion. But it's been the path of inclusion that is more lively at the moment for me, put it that way.
Yeah. Again, though, you absolutely. And there's this has to be a recognition that both need to be understood, recognized, and included as the fullness of reality.
Yep.
This deep, deep, boundless silence of being, and this dynamic manifestation of expression, endlessly stirring in its diversity and color and whatnot. You risk missing it if you try to exclude one of them.
Absolutely.
And of course, I'd make the case that for the most part, the most common issue that people miss is the transcendent ground.
Yeah.
Because we're caught up and only know the manifestations, the arisings, the appearances of phenomenal transient being. And that's knowing only that is a huge problem for our sense of well-being, peace, joy. So we need to find that which we've overlooked, our ground, our conscious ground, our deeper ground, our foundational ground. But I remember a couple of years ago, I remember talking about observing, looking back over how my path went in a brief nutshell kind of way, was that as a young man caught up in the typical affliction of life, knowing only the world and its contents and whatnot. But at a certain point, my attention turned inwards and followed it all the way in, all the way in, all the way in for a long, long time. Meditation, self-inquiry, reflection, introspection. So my attention was there, always going inward. And then that journey within, let's say, became abiding and recognized it as my ground.
Yeah. You weren't journeying too, you were.
No, I was. I found what I was seeking. I came to the end of my seeking. And then, interestingly, the attention opened up and kind of started to include the world. Oh, yeah. I started to notice things about the world. I started to be aware of them. God, I wasn't even aware that was going on or this and that. And I realized how intensely my journey was inward. Yeah. But then once that abidance, once I discovered and was living from that ground, then the attention turned outward again, so to speak. Started to include all that I had been dismissing and unattending to, which is the path of a seeker, in a sense. You know, if you turn your attention within, drop into that.
To
become that.
Yeah, to the exclusion of all else for a time. For a time. You can't stay there, actually, no. Though. Then there's the that becomes the rejection of the world.
Well, I remember.
For some, they see some that stay there for maybe a little bit too long.
Well, I remember. Yeah, exactly. I think that's what I said. Adyashanti talked about being lost in the transcendent. Mm. So it's so blissful and so, you know,
appealing. Well, this world is so full of suffering.
But I think it's a natural phenomenon for that attention then to be released from the contraction of that spiritual seeking. Once it's found its ground, it just pops, it opens up. And then I started to notice the world in a way that I hadn't really beforehand. And I remember being what came to me was the real recognition of there's no spiritual and everything is spiritual. There's no category called spirituality, really.
No.
It just is. It's just what is. And it's all, it's the idea, it's all sacred or none of it's sacred. Well, actually, it's all sacred. There's no single category. Oh, and so some of the bells and whistles and the spiritual affectations can fall away after that. Because it's just all spiritual. It's all spirit. It's all every breath,
every moment, every breath.
Can't separate it out.
Every experience, every emotion, sensation, thought, phenomenal arising, everything. Consciousness dancing.
And it's a question of what does being spiritual look like then? Because you know, you see it as seekers, and I played that part myself. Oh, spiritual looks like certain clothes, certain, you know,
way things of speaking, you might wear,
way of speaking,
language,
activities that you do.
Yeah, what you eat.
Because it's partial and it's particular and it's, in a sense, divided. It's don't get me wrong, it's the path you need, a seeker needs to follow that focus in order to support the the introspection and the discovery and the exploration. But then the whole thing pops and it's like, oh, it's all this. And I've thought about this before, talking about narratives. That, you know, I've got a little bio on my website, a sort of spiritual bio, this did that, followed this, did this teaching, you know, had this insight, all that. It's a reasonable enough narrative. But in reality, I can't exclude anything at all that happened, quotes, as instrumental to, if you want to look in those causal terms, instrumental to awakening. It's just all essential.
It was all the path.
So my you know, my art practice or my difficult relationships or...
Your misspent youth.
My misspent youth. Or anything else. Life is itself, I've said before, life is an awakening machine kind of thing. It's not a machine, not that gross, but it's
all in
it's
support.
For awakening. Yeah. It's all about returning home.
Yeah, every experience, and that this is when I talk of it about inclusion. This is what I'm talking about. It's like every experience is for you.
Yeah, don't say, oh, I don't want that experience because that's not serving my seeking, my growth, my spirituality, my well-being. No. That's, if it's happening, it's essential.
Yeah.
And instrumental in its providential.
And so in light of that insight, it does change the relationship with life. When you see that, when you finally grok that, you get that, you go, yes.
Yeah.
All of it. Part of my experience, all the difficulties, all the sufferings, all the doubt and the questioning and the beautiful experiences as well, the beautiful spiritually, all of it
is
through all of this, is revealing what is underneath all of this, who and what I am fundamentally.
Yeah. And I was funny if I was looking up this idea of like provisional versus sort of definitive teachings, and I thought refresh my mind on it and sort of look back at what has been said about that, and it's very much what we've said, talks about it before, but a provisional view would be something in relation to the person or to karma or to cause and effect, or to sadhana, paths, all that.
Doing.
Whereas definitive teachings are very much about the nature of reality itself.
Yeah.
You know, what it is, how
and
it is.
And there's room for both.
Well, the definitive meaning, that which defines that. Right. So, and there are things like emptiness, but also things, and I really love this because one of my favorite it's a minor influence for me, but it is definitely an influence in Taoism, and I love, actually it's in Buddhism too, there was a big crossover, but this idea of suchness, thusness, actually one of the names of the Buddha, the great name is Tathagata, I think it's something like he who was attained thusness or thus, but that idea that thusness, it is simply as it is, unadorned, perfect, thus, nothing to do, nothing wrong, nothing broken, nothing separated, it simply is thus, and that, and living from that thusness is even. So even from a seeking point of view, even the seeking is suchness.
Exactly. Even the suffering and the doubts and the, you know, seeking, is as it must be.
Yes, as it is.
You know,
so there's no bondage, no liberation.
No, even this idea of ego, I'm in the ego. It's like, even that, in the definitive viewpoint, the absolute viewpoint, is seen as entirely necessary and entirely a yeah. part of what is.
Yes. That's a definitive teaching.
And yet provisionally, and there's great...
Yeah, getting to that, figuring out what that is, being someone who's seeking that.
Yeah, and very useful to go, oh, that's the ego. Oh, that's the, you know, the idea of gaining clarity of the different parts of experiencing that are at play.
Yeah. So the provisional teachings are to help someone along, help quote someone, quotes along the path.
Until they realize
the suchness of being.
Yeah. What is?
There's the Diamond Sutra. I really love it. I think it's the Diamond Sutra, where, you know, the Buddha asks one of his, you know, bhikkhus, whatever, says, tell me, you know, have I got all the merit in the world? We say, yeah, absolutely. You know, have I attained all that there is to attain? Yes. Am I completely unparalleled in my wisdom and insight? Yes. But also tell me, he was testing his devotee, he was testing, but also tell me, is there no path? Is there no Buddha? Is there no teaching? Is there no merit? And he went, absolutely.
Mm.
And so in that small little discourse, it illustrated the nature between the difference that the two truths that you have to, as long as there's a seeker, you employ strategies and teachings to help the seeker along the path, but only to the full realization that there's no seeker, there's no path, there's no liberation, there's no bondage. Life is reality as suchness. And it's all good, both and. But digression there.
I don't know.
But I would say there's an importance, and I love the fact that, you know, this has become really explicit in how you approach your work. That along the way, we have to keep including, keep including, keep including, keep including. And it's that non-exclusion of the manifest, of the transient.
And actually, for me, it goes even one step further, I would say, beyond inclusion, which is a huge part of what I feel is really important message, is the love of all that is manifest. And, you know, when we see it as transient, there's two ways we can go. We can go very nihilistically. So we can go, oh, none of this is important. All of this is... You know,
which is a very arguably the masculine and a really effective netty-netty in a sense.
Exactly. But it's funny, and this, it's not something I set out to do or come about to, but it is something that has happened to me. And it is the way of love. It is the way of, it's like I'm, as life is unfolding more and more, I'm seeing, feeling, and experiencing life in its relative temporary form as sacred, as entirely sacred, as every expression, the dance of the divine. And for me, this came about through the guidance and the wisdom that Divine Mother was showing me. In who and what she is, and her encouragement of seeing that that is who and what I am, who and what we all are. And so in that, it has transformed my life. And I'm getting quite emotional because it's made me fall in love with life. It's made me fall in love with every expression of life, even the most painful expressions. And that's not something, it's not for everyone. I understand that. I understand that that is not how everyone sees life and experiences life. Because it is uncompromising in its unconditionality. And there's zero judgment from me of if that someone is not seeing life in that way, but it is how I see life. And I feel so incredibly called to live that so wholly, so wholeheartedly. It's like every time life reveals to me some part that is deemed unlovable, unsavory, unlikable, it's like, it's for me, it's just a calling to open to that, to deepen to that further, to love that. And it's a different kind of love. I don't even know how to begin to express. I mean, I'm constantly trying, but I don't really know how to express this different kind of love. It's not human kind of love at all. It's not about gaining anything.
It's funny. I did a little, I was interested the other day because for a long time, I mean, I've been interested in Buddhist teachings and whatnot. I was curious to know, because I hadn't really come across it much in Buddhism, love. Mm. And I thought, let me just do a little research and see what the Buddha said about love. And it was quite an interesting thing. I was using these sort of AIs, Bard and ChatGPT and whatnot. Good, it's a handy bit of research if you want a shortcut to finding out. And I said, what did the Buddha say about love? And what was really interesting is that with both of these AIs, both of these sort of the responses was, and I found it very telling. The Buddha never said much about romantic love, and I was like, I wasn't talking about romantic love,
yeah,
right? And then I asked another one that said a similar kind of thing. The Buddha never used, but I mean, talk about love, and then went into metta, loving kindness, sure. So and compassion and these virtues and these things that one would develop along as you go. But I found it really telling, culturally speaking, that so what this AI was doing was picking up on everything that's been written about stuff and consolidating it and distilling it and offering it back to me, a kind of a condensation of some, you know, the what's been written. But I find it really telling that the instinct, but the cultural reflection when you use the word love is always about romantic love.
Yeah, and it's always and about it's, the object of love,
right? And
not
it was
the subject
and I just,
of love.
That's what struck me. I thought that is such a culturally narrow view we have.
It's a blind
of
spot.
Love. Like love is just about. But love is the very substance of being. This is what it's the very nature of being. It's the very directionality of being. It's the very goal of being. It's so that falling in love with life is, in a sense, embodying, returning to our very nature. It's not what, and this is, so we, often in awakening teachings talk a lot about awareness, talk a lot about consciousness, which is absolutely right. But the nature of that consciousness is not simply conscious. It's also, as we can discover in our own hearts, it's love, it's bliss, it's...
Yeah, I would say that doesn't necessarily wake up immediately.
No, it
so
took
you can have
after,
an awakening,
afterwards
yeah.
it took in the couple of years following
really
started to deepen in my own sense of love, and so that notion of falling in love with life that became,
you can have a profound,
really in it, a profound
you can have a, sorry to interrupt,
no carry
you.
On you can have
you can have a profound awakening to your nature, your transcendental nature, your that of awareness, that of consciousness. And that is a profound recognition.
Yeah.
But it is probably, I would describe it as the first stages of awakening. I think there is, so that's what traditionally a lot of people talk about ascending
right.
teaching. So there's an ascent, but there is also then a descent that happens. And this is, I think, what we're talking about today, yeah. broadly speaking, is yeah. the descent into the heart
right.
is the embodiment of those transcendental teachings, is the embodiment of being human.
I just find that. So there's two ideas, okay? I say ideas, but they're concepts relating to the same, to me, at least aspects of the same thing. So if you look east, you often hear the word ananda or bliss.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look to the Western teachings, you'll find love more. Mm-hmm. And love as agape, mm-hmm. which is universal love.
Unconditional
love. Universal love. And in the east, it's like this idea that the very substance of reality is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
It's which is what contentment, peace, but it includes love. And I would say something like love is bliss in motion or something like that, yeah. right? It's the same thing, but in the when it's experienced in the human realm, it's yeah. love. I mean, it's also bliss, just simply bliss, that's upswelling of well-being, but that just spills over into all the objects of experience.
Yeah.
I keep hitting my mic stand, so if you hear a boing, please forgive it. right? Something like that.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to find this what are they both pointing to? Because because love doesn't seem quite like bliss. Bliss seems very, you know, self-oriented or something, and just an experiential, but it's somehow how bliss shows up, how love shows up.
Yeah.
The dynamic aspect. The tenderness with which we meet the object, right? That that deep sense of love and devotion with which subject and object are dissolved.
Yeah. The true union of life
experienced. And that's the heart, that even though the awareness, the mind, let's say,
mm-hmm.
the liberated mind sees no separation.
Yeah.
But the heart, the liberated heart, feels no separation.
I was about to say the same, yeah. It feels no separation.
And it's those two
yeah.
complementary.
And it's the union of that. And there's where, for me, is the masculine and feminine of the two. The mind, the liberated mind yeah. I would argue, has a masculine yeah. fragrance to it.
Sure.
And the liberated heart
has a cracked, open, full
female fragrance to it. And again, I'm not talking about men and women here. I'm talking about masculine and feminine. I'm
Even though
that I, yeah, typically
it does actually often show up that
does,
way,
but
it's not necessary.
I do think that there is the fragrance of both in all of us in different amounts, let's call
yeah.
it.
Yeah, for sure.
The outward expression of that, maybe the outward expression of the heart opening may be seen more in the female expression, yeah. and the outward expression of yeah. the open mind may be seen in the more male. And I see it with you and I
yeah.
Very much so. You know, we're speaking of the same thing, and yet we have very different ways of
yeah.
communicating that, and the way in which we experience that as well,
yeah.
and our emphasis and our sort of
but
where
it,
our direction of pointing might
but it's really use. Interesting that, you know, when I look back at what I've been writing these last few years, wow, so much of it's become this really bliss filled love devotional sense of being,
yeah,
just in informing my expressions about. And I think there's something about, as you've been talking about, the expression sometimes takes a minute to catch up to what's revealed.
Yeah.
Sometimes, well, especially if you're not, you talk about your website, you know, it's not quite expressed because so much has gone on, so much has yeah. blossomed in your heart and how you maybe verbalize it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're gonna have to put pen to paper.
Oh, such a task at hand. It takes so long.
To kind of spontaneously, yeah, verbally articulate that.
Yeah. It's like, for instance, this weekend is like, I am imbibed with the feeling of what this weekend is, but you ask me to describe it, I have a hard time. Yeah. It's not the words. The words are so secondary. They're so, like, the felt energetic sense of an experience is so entirely wholesome. What I mean by that mm-hmm. is, like, all-encompassing, like, wholehearted. Like, right. It's so multidimensional, multifaceted. It is experienced on so many levels and layers and dimensions of life that it is impossible, or at least it's difficult to, it's like the bandwidth of communication is too slim.
Yeah, it's going to take, it takes a while for the mind to sort of distill exactly it into word, yeah. a descriptive narrative.
Which is never going to be capturing the whole thing.
No, of course. But it's sort of the mind's job, in a sense, to pick out what's important.
Yes. Yes. And so that can take time.
It does, yeah.
That can take time. And there has to be patience for that process. And I feel I've had to have an enormous amount of patience, which for me is luckily not outside of the realms of possibility. But... an enormous amount of patience.
With yourself?
With myself.
With life.
In terms of, you know, again, it's the whole public nature of right. teaching publicly that makes it a little tricky, because it's like, you know, there's something in the depths that wants to be expressed,
right.
yet the expression is not yet caught up to it. Mm. And so just by the very presence of your being, it yeah. is already expressed.
You're already living yeah. it out.
But the verbal expression yeah. of that, the overt naming of that
yeah.
is not maybe yet quite caught up. And it's coming.
Yeah.
I feel it. But, and I've said this to you and I've said this to many people, I feel like a baby in all of this.
Yeah.
In all of this, I feel like a baby. I feel like, you know, awakening takes hold. A remembrance of our nature takes hold. And I think it takes years.
Yeah, I agree.
I know the Buddhists,
I've heard it said,
7 years or
yeah,
things like
once
that.
Yeah, once a mendicant awakes, send them off to the forest to live in a hut for seven yeah. years and then come back or something like that.
And I think that
because it, takes
it can
time.
Be different for each person. Yeah. But
you've got to live it out. I mean, the thing is, you know, in awakening in the modern world, there's no, you know, there's no, how many monks among us? How
exactly.
many nuns? You know, we're just... Right, yeah, we act, and well, that's interesting because we do, in some sense, act a bit like that. Yeah. We talked about it before. You know, I live a very, and both of us live a very sort of introspective life still, but at the same time, we live in a house
yeah.
with a car, and we go for walks, and you know, down the streets, and
go to the supermarket to go shopping.
Exactly, and I wonder whether that's actually an interesting. Manifestation or challenge of the modern age that people are awakening.
Yeah.
And we don't have the, let's say, the context that was present, has been traditionally present in times past, which is to say monasteries and hermitages and that the people who would awaken were often people who were sadhus, sannyasins, monks, whatever. They had excluded themselves from society and living in a different context.
I think we don't
so we have to do it within.
Yeah, we don't have the blueprint, the model for what it is to live an awakened life in amongst the modern day.
Yeah.
situation. And I think we are getting those blueprints.
We're carving them out.
Yeah,
actually.
And the more and more teachings and teachers of the modern age that are living this life,
yeah,
they are figuring that out as they go and yeah. modeling that. They are creating that blueprint. And it's not, I don't want to be mistaken in what I mean here and not saying that everyone's going to look the same.
No.
I'm talking about the underlying archetypal type blueprints that show us how to be, embodied, how to be living and working and interacting in this way. And I think it's a journey
I think it is
for this modern life.
And it's a beautiful thing, because I think each awakened being becomes the catalyst for and a model, let's say, for others to follow, not follow in a, you know, but to, yeah, modeling
what it is
by finding out ourselves. What is it to live, you know, do we sort of just wake up and go about our business as usual? That's not been my experience. My experience has been waking up has been a transformation of the way I live my day, the way I go about my life, the things I've dropped and are inclined towards and not inclined towards. And we as cells in the collective organism then begin to change the nature of the organism, actually, by modeling, by following a more natural way. And I mean natural in the truest sense, the spontaneous, aligned way.
Sahaja Samadhi.
Sahaja Samadhi, the natural state. So that's interesting to see what those individual cosmic cells will do to the organism as a whole. And because there's something about, I mean, something beautiful, and there's something almost heartbreaking about awakening when you come into this. And this is the missionary in me. when you come into this sense of bliss and boundlessness, you wish it for others. You know, even though there is no other, right, in some sense, but that, but also others are that your beloved self.
Exactly.
We feel it all.
Yeah.
And you see people suffering the afflictions that in some sense are self-created.
Yeah.
And you kind of know the answer to that, or at least the way to help them see something more deeply in their own nature that will relieve them of those sufferings. That
which you have discovered and remembered for yourself.
But I've learned that zeal is not the not the way forward for me, even though my tendency is to, you kind of want to, yes, try this, do that, look at this.
Yeah.
And you can expand that viewpoint and imagine a world. What's his name? Charles Eisenstein wrote a book, something like The Beautiful World We All Know Is Possible, something like that. And the idea is that, you know, when you drop into your own self, when you realize the beauty and bliss of being, when you fall in love with reality, fall in love with life, you can't help but wish it for others would have that loving existence too.
Yeah.
That liberation, that bliss, that field of all possibilities, embracing all of that. You kind of want that, and you can imagine, in a sense, a world where that's possible.
Yeah.
For all.
And I've always said this, the awakening process, part of the awakening process is a grieving process, I feel.
Yeah.
As well. The grieving process for the dreams that you had for you as a person, the grieving process for the world that is suffering, the grieving process for the lost time that you were suffering previously. You know, there's and many more. I could name many more.
This is what I've come to see and come to experience, is that in the same way as I hold my own grief or discomfort or afflictive, hold that and let that be and welcome that, embrace that, love that. It's the same for the world. You have to just hold the exactly. world with that compassion, with that love,
yeah.
even in the suffering. And of course, we want to relieve other people's suffering, and it's yeah. and you know it's there. That possibility is there
yeah.
when they're ready to go there.
Yes, I think for me, fundamentally, it is to unconditionally accept the other, even their suffering, even their seeming self-inflicted suffering.
And I like the seeming
self-inflicted. Yeah, seeming. Seeming is an important word there. And to not fix.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as we look at another or ourselves
yeah.
and look to fix, we don't see them as they are. We don't see right. life as it is. Mm-hmm. And we don't see the perfection of life as it is and the journey that someone is going on.
Yeah.
That is entirely correct.
Yeah.
And
difficult
so
as it is to hold that feeling.
Yeah. And so there's the hubris, the arrogance of the human that feels yeah. it knows.
Yeah.
And so this is why, to me, I talk of surrender, because it's like to talk of surrender is to talk of love.
Mm.
To talk of love is to recognize that we are all held unconditionally as we are in life, and that all that we are experiencing is in service of the recognition and the remembrance of our true nature, of our divine nature. And so to, although the expression of wanting to fix and, mm-hmm. and solve and not have someone suffer and then mm-hmm. therefore the grief of that is laudable, is honorable.
It's compassionate.
It is compassionate.
The immersion of compassion. But if you start to try to impose that.
Exactly.
And not trust actually that from within life is
yeah.
unfolding their path.
It's to not meet someone. It's to not yeah. see them for who they are right. and to see the expression of the divine even in the suffering,
yeah.
even in the great suffering of life. To see beyond that and see that actually, even with that, they are still the divine dancing.
Thusness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it's difficult for people to see the divine in those difficult moments of life.
I had it's funny because I had I'd written a piece all about ascension and global ascension, this idea that, oh, we're at the threshold of a global awakening and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, sure, maybe. But what I saw in it, and I wrote about it, was that the global, this idea of a global ascension, the narrative can very easily be a place in which we hide.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of layers to that. And one of them is that, oh, I'm just going to wait until the whole world wakes up and I'll get along on that bandwagon. Thank you very much. And all the while you're in a sense kicking your own ball down the road rather than attending to the particulars of your own.
Well, forget about global ascension. That's also personal ascension, as in awakening also does that, you know.
Right. Rather than attending to the present, yeah. you're kind of imagining a future.
The promise of awakening.
Yeah. yeah. And so that was, I remember feeling that, oh, that narrative's just really disempowering.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't kind of bring one back to Buddha Dharma Sukhtolit, that our miraculously aware nature
mm-hmm.
and the presence of that we don't even have to wait for it, we don't even have to seek it, we just simply have to recognize it. Okay.
Are we done for today?
I think so. Thanks for joining in, everyone. Thanks for coming and listening. And if you feel like subscribing, please do. If you feel like sharing, or liking, that would be great.
And any comments?
Yeah.
Any feedback is always really welcome.
And I want to say also, any questions? I mean, if you want to put something to us, that would be, we're happy to.
I created a space on the website where they can, at the bottom of the first page, the only page actually at the moment.
On endofseeking.com?
Yeah, there's an opportunity to put your questions in there.
Sure.
So you can write them and we'll...
Yeah, we'll talk about it, answer, or as best we can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Bye for now.